KPCW News Time now, 8:16. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday, and in the studio I have County Council Member Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the County Council did not come to a decision about the Colby appeal?
We're still thinking about it. We had a closed session after our open discussions yesterday, and we're going to meet at least one more time and closed before we make a decision.
Okay, because you did go into closed session after everybody had left, and we didn't know if you had gone back into open session.
No, we figured if people had been there long enough, it was already a long session. So, and we had some further extended discussions and closed.
So what is the next date set for it then?
We're going to have a closed session next Wednesday, and after that, then we'll see.
Okay, because the Woodward appeal comes back on like 28th, I think, March 28th.
It'll be a very short session when we actually announce our decisions. There won't be any further testimony, and we'll just come out and say, okay, each one of us will give our opinion and we'll vote.
Now, you heard from the opposing attorneys yesterday afterward for about 2 hours, four attorneys engaging in a very detailed debate about the definitions and nuances of land use law in the county and the state. And as Rick Bruff told me, you didn't just get into the weeds, you got into very tall weeds. And I know that it's under review still, so there's not a lot we can say. But do we need to get any more further written further verbal or written agreement arguments
no,
from the parties?
No, we're not accepting any more verbal or written arguments. We've gotten probably more information than we ever wanted to have, and we've sifted through it. And like I said, we'll have one more closed session, and we'll make our decision.
Okay. And then Councilmember Roger Armstrong announced that there could possibly be a conflict of interest.
Yes, he did. It's really not much of a conflict of interest. Inadvertently, his wife Beth had retained Joe Rona literally a couple of hours before our meeting in the late in the previous day, and Roger didn't even find out about it until noon, and it's nothing that he has anything to do with.
But it's up to the applicant's attorney to decide whether or not?
They can ask for recusal, but the individual member of the council has to decide, or the council can decide whether the council member needs to recuse themselves. And we kind of made that decision after listening to Roger's story. And Bruce Baird had requested a continuance so he could further talk to his client, and we denied the continuance.
Okay. Let's see, other items on the agenda. How do you feel the county did at the state legislature?
I think we did fairly well. The one major issue that we're still trying to get some motion on is Senate Bill 191, which would affect our ability to affect oil pipelines going through the county and to protect the Weber Basin. We're trying to gather some support from various parties to ask Governor Herbert to veto the legislation. We're fully aware that it is mostly a local issue in Deschene and Uinta County. We don't really want to do anything to harm their particular interest in this bill, but we need to get some relief on our regulatory efforts to protect the watershed. And we already have Weber Basin Water Conservation District in Weber County agreeing with us on that issue. We're waiting for some feedback from several other counties that are affected in the Weber Basin, namely Davis County and Morgan County and Salt Lake County and Utah County. We've asked just on general principles.
Now, is it the case that the governor has to sign every bill? I don't think so. I mean, some just go into law.
Yes. If it had I don't know the details on that. I think he can – I believe he can let things
just
become
happen.
Law without his signature. I believe that's true, but I am not an expert on the governor's signing procedures.
Right. So, but trying to get this in front of him would then somehow stop it?
Well, if he vetoes it, then the only way it would go into effect is a special session was called to override vetoes. And that does occasionally happen. As the law is currently constituted, though, I'm not sure. I guess the legislature can ask for a special session for that particular purpose. But they have to have, usually when that happens, there's several bills that they're disturbed about. Whether this one rises to that importance at this point, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing,
I mean, if it went into law, I mean, and we did see something from Tesoro come back, I mean, they would pretty much have a...
It's not completely out of our hands. We would certainly take some of the provisions of the law to court. The way it's written, you may not unreasonably hinder. So I would think we would probably hang our hat on that and say this is not unreasonable. Protecting the watershed is not unreasonable. But it just makes it more difficult.
And a lawsuit.
And expensive, and delays for everybody.
All right. Let's see. Did the council approve the cooperation agreement and engineering services agreement?
We did. I'm very happy about that. We've talked about that for several months now. We've got all the red lines worked out between our parties, and we're full speed ahead with Rocky Mountain Power. Sometime in the next year and a half, we will see what they have to offer us. We'll make a decision on that, and I'm relatively confident that we're going to find some economic ways to go forward to bring 100% renewable energy to the county. There's really two elements to it. The engineering service agreement affects immediately bringing in renewable energy to county operations, and the cooperation agreement goes further than that to devise a strategy to bring it into the entire county. Now, that's going to require some legislation, and I asked Chad Ambrose from Rocky Mountain Power if they would be starting that during the interim sessions this year. He said they definitely would be, and that they would involve us in that effort.
Did you share Roger Armstrong's objection that the county was not allowed to pursue other energy options outside of Rocky Mountain Power?
Yeah, Roger's had that concern all along, and he voted against it, but the vote was 4-1.
So the issue wasn't resolved. It is how it is.
Yeah, and there's just a period of time of a year and a half where we can't do anything. I'll just give you my opinion on it. The reality is if we're going to get anything done, we're going to have for the county – not necessarily for the county operations, but for county in general, we need to have a partnership with Rocky Mountain Power because we're not going to get our desires through the legislature without their help.
Let's see, an item that was added to the agenda was the contract renewal for County Manager Tom Fisher. Can you tell us about the terms? I mean, is it extended another 3 years? Or?
Boy, I should have brought it with me. It's on my computer. It is extended for a number of years. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. It's either 3 or 5, I believe.
Okay. Does he get a raise?
And it is, yes, he gets a raise, and his raise will then be no more than the raise that everyone else gets with a COLA every year. It's a pretty fair contract. It's similar to contracts of county managers and city managers with similar duties around the state.
Anything in particular that you asked them to improve on, or
that's something I really don't want to talk about. It's kind of a closed session HR issue. Everybody has things that we need to improve on.
Do you feel like he is doing a good job at balancing county manager with his role
at National Guard? Yes, we absolutely do. We're very happy with Tom's performance. Very happy. I don't think we could have found a better county manager for us.
During council comments, Glenn, you said you were contacted by a company looking for a place to put a senior living facility. Is it such a challenge to find a place
land
for that kind of business?
Land is the big problem, yes. This organization, this company, has a history of building medical facilities and some real estate development. And the problem is finding a compatible location around the county. They'd like to have something on a major route and in a residential area. So that somewhat limits the number of plots around. We had a meeting, Kim Carson and I and Tom Fisher with the organization, and we gave them a few suggestions that they're going to pursue.
Yeah,
but it's that has been their biggest obstacle. I actually met with them. A private citizen, the county asked me to meet with them about 6 months ago, and they're still beating their head against the wall to try to find appropriate land.
Yeah, we've got a small village going up at Silver Creek Village. There's no location there.
Could be. That could be one of the possibilities, but that's something that they would have to work out with the landowner over there. You know, we're not getting involved in actually selecting sites for them. We threw out a few suggestions. That was one of them.
All right. And then we've also got the Klein Dolly parcel. I mean, is that something the county would be interested in?
Also a possibility. Mm-hmm. We'll be putting out an RFP later this year for development of that parcel. As many things are on the table as we could throw out to them, because we do think it's a worthwhile endeavor for the county. They have statistics that show that most of our senior citizens who need assisted living and memory care have to leave the county at this time.
Council also talked about a problem that was discussed back in January, short-term rental companies collecting transient room taxes from customers but not passing them on to the state, only Airbnb apparently doing it. So we're talking about millions of dollars. Is it tough getting through to the Utah Tax Commission? Or?
Apparently. They have been totally inactive on this particular issue. So we're researching what measures we can take to prod them a little bit more. Does it require future legislation that we would propose in the legislature? I think the first step is to figure out what our options are in getting them to cooperate and having a meeting with them.
Legal action is also an option?
Actually, no. apparently, we need authorization from the state tax commission to take legal action against outfits like VRBO and HomeAway.
Just real quick, the council retreat, what was your most important takeaway from that?
Oh, that's good. I think there were two major issues. What do we want? We talked about it in two-hour segments. One, what do we think the county should look like if we get, in 2030, assuming we have the Olympic hordes descending upon us on that year? And all of us had different but very compatible ideas on what we think the county should look like in terms of how you get into the county, what the facilities at Kimball Junction might look like, and other issues around the county. And the second issue was affordable housing. How do we promote – how much affordable housing can we effectively build? The study from Wood that we got a couple of weeks ago was striking. Part of the problem is that construction activity is way down – everywhere in the state because of a lack of construction workers. The Wood study shows that we have a demand every year for about 400-plus affordable housing units. There were only 280-some permits taken out in Summit County, in unincorporated Summit County last year. So we're not building enough units in total to meet our affordable housing demand.
That 280 permits wasn't just affordable housing. It was everything.
It was everything.
Yeah. And I'm guessing when you think about the future of what, Summit County or at least the Snyderville Basin would look like, I mean, isn't there some opportunity to do some computer modeling and just show what has been approved? I mean, that would give you a really good view.
Yeah. And we actually asked Pat Putt to come up with a map for us. We certainly know what's been approved, and he knows what's in the pipeline. And then we look around areas that we would like to probably put affordable housing, and maybe come up with some long-term plans on how we approach those areas. Certainly, Klein Dolly is one of them, but that's not the only one.
Yeah, and then in terms of affordable housing, I mean, do we need to put an emphasis on rentals as opposed to for sale units?
Yes, that's what the study showed us. Is that about 2/3 of the demand is in rentals, and it's mostly and most of that 2/3 is actually for people under the 50% AMI range. Those are our resort workers primarily.
And Park City has said that's something they can't do because they need to sell the units so that they can have the money back to continue on doing that. I mean, the county, I'm guessing, has a similar issue.
That's their economic model. We're not going down that path. We're going to try to get outfits like Mountain Lands and Habitat and private developers to come in and provide the affordable housing. Particularly, our next project that we're going to put out an RFP for is Klein Dolly. We'll see what we get from private developers. The other issue we're going to really have to address is density. density around nodes, economic nodes and transportation nodes, the future of trans-oriented design and affordable housing and housing in general really depends upon how much density we put into existing areas. We do not want to spread it out all over the county, but we're going to have to face the possibility of creating higher density in areas that can be serviced by public transportation and have economic viability. So people can walk or bicycle for a lot of their daily activities. One of the examples I put out during our discussion on Monday was Whistler Village. I've been there several times. You know, hardly anybody drives there. You go up in a bus, and it's a complete walking village where you can get anything you want by walking, and I assume in the summer by bicycling. If we could create something like that in the Kimball Junction area, we can put more density there without stressing the transportation system, and by actually getting better utilization out of our transportation system. The key is building density where we have existing nodes and providing the transit between those nodes.
Okay, need to leave it there. Glenn, thanks for your time. Well, the Utah State Legislature has wrapped in the studio with a final recap of how the Park City School District will be impacted. I have School District Business Administrator Todd Halber. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we had heard from UEA President Heidi Matthews that the funding this year was historic. Do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. There's 2.5% on the WPU, and then an equivalent of another 2.1%. So 4.6%, that's highest in most of our memories going into public ed. So that's a good year.
Yeah. So what does this mean for our taxes here locally? The school board has been telling us that a tax increase will be necessary. With all of this new money, maybe not?
Well, it depends. So we had anticipated that the WPU would grow by 2.5%. So that's as planned, and so all our risk-taking has paid off. The challenge will be with the other 2.1%. That money is part of the negotiations that went on with our schools now, and that money comes in a very particular form, and it also comes to the school district on a one-time basis because the negotiations actually aren't concluded. There's some pieces yet to be worked out through the House Joint Resolution 20, which will bring a referendum to the public this November on the gas tax increase and things like that. So there's still some pieces to be worked out. So in the meantime, we have this additional, it's about $65 million is what the 2.1% represents. That would bring about $900,000 into the school district. So that's positive for the district, but it's one time until the rest of the negotiations work out. So we'll have to be careful in how we plan that money so that we don't set ourselves up for having to raise taxes as that 65 gets moved into some other arrangement with our schools now.
All right. So when will you have those numbers?
So I should have those numbers in about 2 weeks. So I'll sit down. There's House Bill 293 increased the basic levy. So there's a new piece called the equity pupil unit. So we'll have to levy that here in our area. That will take about $1.5 million out of our community and send it towards equalization. School district won't see any money come back from that particular piece of legislation. And then we have the Our Schools Now arrangement that's putting this, what's called a WPU value rate on top of the basic rate. That's where that $1 million comes from. As it gets distributed, I don't think we'll see dollar for dollar. We'll probably get something less than $1 million because it'll be distributed on a WPU basis and not on a tax basis.
So could that just be a wash? I mean, given what we pay out for equalization and what comes in?
So definitely. Well, my guess right now is between the two add-ons to the basic levy, we're probably going to see about $2.5 million leave the community. And then the WPU distribution that's been negotiated for this coming school year, we might see up to $600,000 come back to us. So it won't be a wash for Park City for sure.
It sounds more like a $2 million loss.
It does.
So,
but it's not coming from the school district coffers, so to speak. It'll be property taxes that are raised, and so we'll watch those dollars leave the community.
Okay. Let's see. What about legislation with regard to teacher certification? Has that changed at all?
So that was a bill that the school board was putting forward, And so it's not that so much that the certification itself will change, but they were updating the language with regards to words like endorsement and certificates of different types, like the ASLs and the ARIs. There's a long laundry list of different types of licenses. So they went to standardize that so that in board rule, the paths are very clear and we're using nomenclature that people understand.
Right. I mean, I know there was some concern that the state had already, I think, allowed wannabe teachers to be certified. Was that resolved, though? I mean, in terms of there's a different path than going to a four-year college?
So there is definitely a different licensing path that still exists. It's under a new name now. But there is still a path for that. We're still experiencing a teacher crisis. So from the state board's point of view is, well, let's make sure that those who go through that route are able to be qualified as teachers in the classroom, make sure they have classroom management skills. It's great to have subject matter knowledge. You might be coming from private industry and can come in and teach science, but it doesn't mean that you can teach a child. So they want to make sure all of that's in place.
Okay. And then we had also talked earlier on, before the session started, just about the recodification of the education code. So that was done?
Yes, that was accomplished very early in the session. So all subsequent bills were drafted with the new code language. And at the board meeting this Tuesday, I'll ask the board to pass a motion for us to do a technical rewrite of every policy of the district to get all the codes rematched up. And so there's a crosswalk document that'll be out on board docs. People can see how that comes together. But it's just a technical rewrite. We're not trying to rewrite policy, just make sure people know where to go to find information in the code.
That's interesting how we see that happen every year where, I mean, the board spends lots of time just making sure its policy matches now new state law.
It is, and that's one of their primary roles is to oversee the governance of the district and make sure that the correct policies are in place in governing the schools. This is more avoiding busybody work of having to pull up every last one by title, read it in. It'll be a mass effort to just recodify the policy, if you will.
Okay. Anything on the performance and assessment of teachers?
Nothing that I don't think that was addressed this session, at least not to my knowledge.
Okay. What else happened then?
So there was one. There was House Bill 132, which had to do with the juvenile justice amendments. So last year, working with students who were truant or were chronic absenteeism, one of the tools was taken away from a school district, which was to work with the juvenile system and help reach out to those students and their families and bring them back into school, sometimes in a forceful way, but in a very direct way. This bill corrects some of that so that we can now work closely with juvenile justice system, but not quite as we had before. So truancy issues can be addressed, and we have our partner back with the juvenile justice system.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to highlight?
One that'll affect actually everybody, the city, the county, and the school district, was Senate Bill 122, bond election amendments. So Senator Stevenson put a piece of legislation through the past that caps the premium that we can collect on issuing bonds. So if we go to market and we say, well, we're going to raise $50 million, but in the marketplace, because of different market pressures and desires, they might say, well, we'll give you $55 million, but we want a different coupon rate. They want a higher coupon rate for their investment strategies. Well, that looks like additional money. You know, that $5 million that was above the 50 looks like additional revenue, but you have to pay it back. And Senator Stevenson... Excuse me. Senator Stevenson has said that additional $5 million in this example was never authorized by the voters. They only authorized $50 million. And so they took that away. You couldn't have a premium that high, but you could have up to 2% because there is issuance cost. And we hope to garner all the revenues for the projects in a bond, but we also need the ability to capture the costs as well. So... takes an option away in the marketplace, but it brings us more in alignment with a voter decision on bonding.
Okay. Anything else?
Oh, tons of stuff, but we'll work our way through that with the board as we develop policies.
All right. Anything, any incident to report following yesterday's student walkout?
Oh, the students were just awesome to work with. They were well organized, very respectful in what they had done. They put together a very peaceful protest, if you will. And it was great to have them take that voice, share that voice into the community, and have a safe place to do that. So we're grateful for law enforcement that was there, that they had a presence, but they weren't overbearing. And we allowed those students to demonstrate as they had desired, and had no incidents that I'm aware of. You know, after their time, went back into the classes, and school picked up where it needed to.
Yeah, so it happened at high school, at Treasure Mountain, anywhere else?
And Edgar also. So there was an organization there. They pulled themselves together, and again, very, very respectful. It was peaceful, and the opportunity to share their voice was heard.
Okay. Hey, Todd, thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you.
That's Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met on Tuesday. On the phone with the recap, I have Commissioner Candace Hart. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you had an election of a new chair and vice chair. Who are those folks?
Yeah, so B. Peck, who was the vice chair and a previous chair, has returned as the chair. So B. will serve a year as the chair. And then Melina Stevens will be the new vice chair, which should mean that in a year from now, she'll be your next chair.
Okay. Let's see, at Canyons Village, a subdivision plat and condominium plat, any significant issues here, or is this basically routine since you've now finished with the Canyon Spa Master Plan?
Yeah, this is pretty routine stuff. This is just sort of finalizing the plat so that they could get their financing. It had nothing to do with designs and density or development. It was just really about the lines on the map.
All right. Also, a discussion about food trucks. Now, is this because of some state legislation from last year?
No. We were actually working on a food truck ordinance before that, and then now there's been some new movement on food trucks and where they get their health permits from. And I believe now the state law says that a food truck gets a health permit from whatever their home base of operations is. That could be any place in the state. And then they're allowed to move around. I think basically the state's trying to make it easier for food trucks to operate. But Ray Milner had been working on this ordinance prior to that, and then now we're just sort of incorporating that to make sure we don't run against it. But basically there's either a single truck operation or possibly like a food court where you might have multiple trucks park in an area. And we're just trying to provide some guidelines so that if someone wants to come operate in the area, they'll know how to do so and be successful.
Yeah, in the past, at least here in the city limits, food trucks not allowed because of what was considered just the inherent unfairness of those who have brick-and-mortar establishments paying more in taxes. That's not an issue in the basin?
Well, I think that issue would probably, I'm assuming a restaurateur might still have that same issue, but the way the food ordinance or the food truck ordinance would read, they have to be on private property, so you couldn't just say pull up on a street in front of a restaurant. You'd have to find some private property that the owner would let you park the truck on. So I think that's going to somewhat limit it. So if you imagine one of the shopping centers where there's restaurants, that developer, that HOA, or whoever's managing that property would be able to control the food trucks who are on there next to restaurants or not.
Okay. And then what regulations did you set then for those so-called food courts, really the collection of food trucks?
Well, so it wasn't finalized, but generally speaking, it's things like they have to be able to clear out their own trash and what kind of music they can have and what kind of signage they can have, how orderly or neat the place must be, or just that it must be neat and orderly. And then a couple things that were left open was we're trying to figure out, like, if you have a spot of land and you want to put several food trucks in there, well, how many can you put in there? Like, how many is too many? And so we're trying to figure out some sort of way to measure that. And I think right now we're thinking about it in terms of density, so many square feet per food truck so that it doesn't become overcrowded. But I have a feeling this will be one of those things that once this gets passed and food trucks start operating, we'll probably have to I'm assuming we'll identify a few things that need to be readdressed.
Okay, so when do you expect those amendments to be forwarded on?
I'm not sure the final date, but it could be within the next month or so.
All right. And then another item was accessory dwelling units. Any particular issues here?
Yeah, this one's actually pretty interesting because this gets into the idea. So basically what the planning department is saying is people come to them now with designs for, you know, building a house, and then quite often they'll have some sort of accessory unit built in there, which looks to be a rental unit they're trying to build into their house. And for a lot of people, this is how they afford their homes, or how they may even get into a house, is by being able to offset it with rent. And of course, the whole idea of VRBO and nightly rentals comes up. And so what they're trying to look at is a way to allow people to have rentals, but also not open up the floodgates to nightly rentals. And it's in the very early stages of trying to close an ordinance. And this would really apply to new homes, you know, a home that has an accessory unit already. You know, they have to operate under their HOA or whatever other guidelines there may be. This is kind of going to help the planning department with new homes that are coming before them.
Okay, so you've got some work to do on that.
Yeah, that one was, I'd say that's the very early stages, where like the food truck, we feel like maybe one more meeting and it's wrapped up. This one feels like there's probably a few more meetings, just because it's going to be such an important topic and you're going to want to get the language right. And so usually, like, when we see a really early draft like this, we come up with lots of ideas or thoughts, and then that'll get incorporated into the next round, and then we'll really start fine-tuning from there.
Okay. I just want to also ask you, you recently competed in another adventure race, this one in New Zealand. It's called God Zone. What did that involve?
This is a 600-kilometer race over 10 days, so nonstop racing. I think our team finished in just 8 days. It has kind of everything. It's a little crazy. There was lots of whitewater paddling and pack rafts. There was sea kayaking. There was paddling in lakes. There was caving, rappelling, lots of trekking in the jungles. Because it was a sanctioned race in the national parks of New Zealand, we were off the trails and in the bush. Some of the legs would be, you know, 70 hours long of just trekking nonstop. And so it was a pretty bold and grand adventure, but it was all self-induced pain. So, you know, not a lot I can really say about it other than it was a lot of fun. Thankful that my wife, Katie, let me go off and do it.
Yeah, so are the teams of four?
Yeah, so if anybody's familiar with the old Eco Challenge show, it's that. It's basically the modern version of that. And it's a co-ed team of four. You can have any ratio of male-female you want. And then in our case, we had a couple people from the Bay Area, myself from Park City, and then Stephanie's from up in Vancouver. So we've raced together before, but it was the mix of people that came together to compete in the race.
Yeah. Now, do you have to have all of your own equipment, your own bikes and rafts?
Yeah, and it's a ridiculous amount of equipment you have to have for these races. Fortunately, I've been doing it long enough that I think I have most everything. I would say pack rafts is kind of the newer activity in adventure racing, and it's kind of a newer activity, I think, that lots of people in Utah are starting to do. Before this, I had some pack rafting, but at this point now, I feel like I kind of earned my chops at it. And the whitewater section we did was 30 kilometers long of solid class 3 with no real breaks in it, and so taking a pack raft down there was quite interesting. So we had to rent that kind of stuff, but yeah, you're carting your bikes and PFDs and packs and gear, you know, all the way over there.
Yeah, and then do you carry everything with you, or you ride your bike and you can drop it off and somebody will take care of it for you?
Well, you know, interesting enough, this race is a bit of a mix. Typically, you would be that. You might do a trekking stage and then drop everything and then pick up a paddling gear to go do the boat section, and then same thing for a bike. In this race, though, like when we would take off on a pack raft section, and then that would transition to a trekking session, that meant we were carrying everything. So we were breaking bush in the jungle, like in a 35-hour loop, while carrying our pack rafts, PFDs, helmets, and paddles, which is easy. Well, nothing was easy in the daytime because you're in this really dense jungle, the rainforest there. But at nighttime, it came particularly hard because you'd have, like, paddle shafts and things sticking up, and you could only really see what your headlamp was showing. So you would miss all the vines and branches above your head. So I think at one point we were moving as slow as a quarter kilometer an hour through some of it. So, you know, we moved faster at times. It was pretty slow going with some really heavy packs.
Wow. And so you were all staying together and then sleeping when you need to, huh?
Yeah, exactly. In this kind of race, you sleep a little bit more than you would typically. You can imagine if you're on, you know, a Class 3 river and it becomes dark, they don't want you running down it. So you're forced to pull out and find some place on the shore to sleep. And so that's not desired in the race from a racing perspective. It does mean that you're going to have to be able to camp out there overnight. And when you have a race that's this long and just sort of this big, you do have to sort of plop down and get like a couple hours sleep a night. So we try to get about 2 to 3 hours sleep a night, as much as we could.
Wow. And are there food stops and equipment stops along the way? Or if you run out of food, out of food.
Yeah, no, we ran out of food once. We had we were moving with like 20. So we were calculating 200 calories an hour per person while you're moving that you need to eat. So that's how we figure out like in terms of hours of food. So we had 24 hours of food on us, and we calculated that the trek was going to take 35 hours. And so suddenly you're rationing and sharing food and treating it a little differently. But no, it's whatever you can carry, which is also slightly different. A lot of races, you would be able to get food or your boxes or, you know, resupply bins. In this case, this race is just, you know, you're out of the country because they clearly were not as worried about liability. You know, they're willing just to chuck you into a river and let you go, or willing to send you off in the jungle on your own. And we heard a few helicopters because we know a few people got airlifted out, but you're just kind of out there on your own, cruising around with whatever food you can carry, trying to get the race done.
Okay, 8 days, huh? I think I read that the winner took almost 5.5 days.
Yeah.
So that's pretty
exactly.
darn fast.
It's actually, it's amazingly quick. You know, the Kiwis are so used to just breaking through this bush. And I think that's fundamentally the difference in speed, is they will just move through with such, I don't know, focus or determination and just sort of bash through the bush, where most of us are just kind of used trying to get our footing and getting used to it, and everything's kind of moist and rotten, so you reach out to hold on to a tree and it just falls over, and or you step on a down tree and it will just crumble under your feet. And I think the navigation in there, it was so dense that some of the traditional ways we would use to make sure we don't get lost were harder for us, where I think the Kiwis are just more used to it. Now, they're a hardy bunch for sure, and phenomenal athletes. Yeah, the elite teams are incredible.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That sounds quite the feat. Hey, thanks for
thanks
for checking in with us. That's Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Candace Hurt.